The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
Dolly and the Day That Never Was by Victoria Crenshaw. Fifty-two-year-old, single, with one faithful cat named Zozo, and a job she didn't exactly love but did very well. Every morning without fail, her alarm clock rang at exactly 6:15 a.m. She would rise, stretch her arms toward the ceiling, whisper a quick prayer, and then shuffle to the kitchen to make tea. Her cat, Zozo, fat, gray, and full of judgment, would always watch her from the top of the stairs as though supervising. Then together, they'd begin their synchronized routine. Dolly humming gospel tunes under her breath, Zozo flicking his tail to the rhythm. But on this particular Tuesday, something was off. The alarm that refused to ring. When Dolly finally opened her eyes, it was not to the cheerful blare of her alarm, but to the soft patter of rain against her window. She squinted at the clock. 7:02 a.m. "What in the world?" she gasped, sitting up so fast she nearly toppled off the bed. The alarm's little red light blinked mockingly. Dead batteries, of course. "Oh, no, Zozo, we are late," she cried, throwing the blanket aside. Zozo stretched, yawned, and then deliberately, almost cruelly, began walking very slowly down the stairs. His plump paws took each step as though he had all the time in the world. "Move your tail, you lazy creature," Dolly shouted, hopping on one foot as she struggled to pull on her skirt. "You'll make me miss the bus." Zozo simply blinked at her. His slow descent continued, one paw at a time. Dolly finally got past him and rushed out the door. The bus stop was empty except for puddles and the smell of diesel. She sighed, rain already soaking her hair scarf. That was only the beginning. The day that refused to be kind. Determined not to surrender to bad luck, Dolly ran back inside, grabbed her umbrella, and without realizing it, left her lunch sitting right on the stove, the burner still on low. As she stepped into the storm, the sky seemed to mock her. A car zoomed by. Splash! Cold brown water drenched her skirt. She groaned and wiped her face, muttering, "Lord, take me now." Then another car passed. Splash! And another, and another, and another. 5 times, 5 separate vehicles found her. By the 5th splash, Dolly stood in the street like a drenched statue, glaring at the traffic. "You all planned this, didn't you?" she yelled into the wind. "You evil motorists." An old man under an umbrella stopped and stared. "Are you all right, madam?" She turned sharply. "Do I look all right?" He nodded solemnly. "You look baptized." The hot mess in heels. By the time she arrived at the office, Dolly's shoes squelched with each step and her mascara looked like a crime scene. She ran to her desk, hoping no one would notice, but her supervisor, Mr. Banda, was waiting. "Ah, Dolly," he said, his smile too wide, "you're finally here. The shareholders are waiting in the conference room. You are presenting first." Dolly froze. "Presenting what?" "The quarterly performance report. You did the slides yourself." Her stomach dropped. "That's today?" Mr. Banda's smile faltered. Yes, Dolly, it's been on the calendar for 3 weeks. She bolted for the restroom. The mirror did her no favors. Her hair was a soggy bird's nest. Her blouse clung in weird places. She looked like someone who'd wrestled an umbrella and lost. Oh, sweet Jesus, she whispered. This cannot be my life. She leaned forward, breathing hard. Her reflection blinked back at her, only it wasn't perfectly synced. Dolly blinked again. Her reflection didn't move. What in the... Then suddenly the reflection smiled, a slow, eerie smile that she hadn't made. Wake-up call. Her heart pounded. She shut her eyes, and when she opened them again, she was in bed. The alarm clock was ringing cheerfully at 6:15 a.m. Wait, she muttered. What? Zozo sat at the foot of her bed, licking his paw. She touched the clock. It was fine. The light was steady. The rain had stopped. Did I just dream all that? She asked aloud. Zozo meowed, a deep, throaty sound that almost sounded like a laugh. Deja vu or madness? Trying to shake it off, she got out of bed and went through her normal morning motions. Tea, scarf, shoes. As she descended the stairs, she noticed Zozo again. He was watching her, tail swishing. Only this time, his mouth moved. Don't miss your bus, Dolly, he said in a calm, gravelly tone. She froze mid-step. Her cup of tea slipped from her hand and shattered on the floor. Zozo, she whispered. The cat yawned. Hurry, you'll be late again. She stumbled backward, grabbing the railing. Oh, no, 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 no. I'm still dreaming. I have to be. Zozo tilted his head. Do you want to test it? The second storm. Dolly pinched her arm hard. Ow, she yelled. Did that hurt? Asked Zozo. Yes. Then maybe it's real. Or maybe pain exists in dreams? Zozo shrugged. If cats could shrug. Either way you should go, the bus will be gone in 1 minute. Panicking, she dashed out the door. The rain started again, exactly the same. Same dark sky, same cold drizzle. The five cars passed, one after another, splashing her in perfect rhythm. By the fifth splash, she screamed, I refuse this nonsense. The old man appeared again, same umbrella, same look. You again? What do you mean again? He frowned. You shouted the same thing yesterday, madam. The mirror's game. At work, she ran straight to the restroom this time. She looked at her reflection and waited. Come on, she whispered. Her reflection blinked out of sync again. Then it spoke. You're late, Dolly. She gasped, who are you? I'm you, said the mirror, or maybe you're me. It's hard to tell these days. This is madness, Dolly said. Is it, or is the madness outside the mirror? The fluorescent lights flickered. Dolly backed away. I just want to wake up, she whispered. The reflection leaned closer, lips curling. Then close your eyes. Loop two. She did, and woke up, again, in bed. 6:15 a.m., alarm ringing, Zozo sitting at the foot of her bed. Only this time the alarm display flickered between 6:15 and 7:02. Zozo purred, which one do you believe, Dolly? She grabbed the alarm clock and shook it. I'm not playing these games. The numbers scrambled, 8:45, 3:10, 11:59, then blank. Her hands trembled. God help me, I'm losing it. Zozo hopped down and began walking, slowly, down the stairs. Each step echoed louder than it should have. Dolly followed, her heart racing. The air felt thick, like she was underwater. When she reached the kitchen, the stove light was on. Her lunch pot was simmering. The smell of burnt rice filled the room. "I left that yesterday," she murmured. "Didn't I?" Time folds. She checked her phone. The date read Wednesday, June 12. She frowned. "It was Tuesday a moment ago." Zozo leaped up onto the counter. "Time is flexible when you don't believe in it," he said. "Cats do not talk," Dolly shouted. "Neither do clocks that lie," said Zozo. "Stop. Make me." Her hands gripped the counter until her knuckles whitened. "This is just stress, that's all. I've been working too much. Maybe I fainted. Maybe I'm in the hospital." Zozo licked his paw. "And maybe the hospital is dreaming of you." The presentation. Her phone buzzed. It was Mr. Banda. "Dolly, where are you? The shareholders are waiting." She looked down at herself, still in pajamas. "But I thought I did that presentation." "Dolly, please don't embarrass me today. Hurry." She stared at the phone. "If this is another dream..." "Then make it a good one," Zozo said, hopping off the counter. The third awakening. When she blinked again, she was standing in front of the conference room projector. Her slides were on the screen. Everyone was watching her. Her boss smiled expectantly. Her heart thumped. She tried to speak, but the words wouldn't come. Her throat felt heavy like cotton. The shareholders started murmuring. Suddenly, all of them turned their heads in perfect unison towards the window. Rain poured outside. A bus splashed past the glass, spraying water across it. The room went silent. Then Zozo's voice echoed faintly, "You missed the bus again, Dolly." "The hospital," she screamed, and everything went black. When she opened her eyes, she was in a hospital bed. Tubes, machines, a nurse adjusting her blanket. "Oh, thank God," she said weakly. "I'm awake." The nurse smiled. "You've been asleep for 2 days, Mrs. Jameson. You fainted at work." Relief flooded her. "So it was all a dream." The nurse checked her chart. "You must have been very tired." Dolly sighed. "You have no idea." Then she noticed something. The nurse's name tag. Zozo. Her eyes widened. "Excuse me, your name is Zozo?" The nurse smiled. "Yes, after my mother's cat. Why?" Dolly's hand gripped the blanket. "No reason," she whispered. Outside the window, rain began to fall. Return to normal? 2 weeks later, Dolly was back home trying to rebuild her routine. Her doctor had recommended rest and light activity, so she brewed tea, brushed Zozo's fur, and told herself over and over that was all just a dream. Yet every now and then, she'd catch Zozo staring at her, eyes gleaming too intelligently. One night, unable to sleep, she heard him whisper something, just one word. "Again." She sat up in bed. "What did you say?" Zozo was curled in his basket, snoring softly. "Nothing," she told herself. "I'm imagining things." Tomorrow that never comes. The next morning, her alarm blared at exactly 6:15 a.m. She smiled. Normalcy. Finally. She turned to look for Zozo. He wasn't on the bed. "Zozo?" A faint sound came from the stairs. She stepped out of bed and saw him, walking slowly, deliberately, one paw at a time. Her smile faded. "No," she whispered, "not again." She looked at the clock, 7:02 a.m. Her breath caught in her throat. "No." She grabbed the clock and shook it. "Wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up." The clock beeped. The rain began. A horn honked outside, then splash. Water sprayed across her face. But she was inside her bedroom. She looked up. The ceiling was leaking, rain pouring directly into her room. Zozo spoke again. "You're late, Dolly." The final scene. Dolly laughed hysterically. "Fine, I'm late. Who cares anymore?" She walked downstairs, soaking wet, her slippers squishing. The house was full of mirrors, every wall, every surface, reflecting infinite versions of herself. Each reflection moved differently. One Dolly was crying, another was brushing her hair, another was giving the presentation confidently. "Which one is real?" she asked. Zozo jumped onto the kitchen counter. "All of them? None of them? You decide." "I want to wake up, then sleep," she stared at him. "And if I'm asleep, then dream better," he said. Epilogue. A dream that never ends. The next day, if there was such a thing as next anymore, her neighbor knocked on her door. No answer. She tried again. Still nothing. When the landlord finally opened the door, the house was spotless. Teacup on the table, lunch neatly packed on the stove, alarm clock blinking, 6:15 a.m., and Zozo sitting calmly on the stairs, eyes bright. He looked at the landlord, tail swishing slowly, and said in a soft, almost amused voice, "She finally caught the bus." This is probably not as simple as the first story, but The Pulse in the Pines was written by Molly Alderson. She awoke under the cover of trees, blanketed in soft dew, their dark green colors not yet exchanged for crimson. She opened her eyes and was met with the harshness of the morning breeze, brushing against her exposed skin and pulling small strands of hair from behind her ears. "You shouldn't pull your hair back too much," she heard her mother's voice ringing through the trees. "People will think you're a boy." It appeared her mother and the wind had made some sort of deal that day to expose Eliza as the woman she was, but neither the wind nor her mother's memory could remove the days of soot and dirt caked to her skin and under her nails. Her black leggings and sweatshirt were so filthy they had almost taken on a new color, partly blood, partly mud, from days of sleeping outside and learning how to hunt for her dinner. "I should get moving," she thought, padding around the pine straw to find her glasses. When she slid them on, the world came into focus. The surrounding world, that is, the one she could see clearly now. Tall pines, maples, squirrels darting through branches as if nothing had happened. Not the state of the world itself. That part was entirely unclear. The last thing she'd heard, the reason she was in the woods to begin with, was that the hunters were out and that she was not safe. She wished she had been able to grab her radio on the way out to hear what was happening in the surrounding areas, but she knew something like that, a confiscated and banned device, would paint a bright, traceable target on her back. She looked down at her forearm, still unhealed, scabbing and bleeding for 4 days straight. She wasn't sure if the infection or the hunger would kill her first. When she touched it lightly, pain shot through her. Ah, she flinched, watching it throb beneath her fingertips. The thick red lines were inflamed and angry, encircling the jagged holes she'd cut herself with the only thing she had on her, the keys to her Jetta to dig out the tracker. The scar pulled her backward hard to that moment in Dr. Palazzi's office. Fluorescent lights buzzing like hornets, a refrigerator humming in the corner, the chemical bite of antiseptic and the metallic taste it left in her mouth. She remembered the waiting room had been crowded that day, women with babies, two old men arguing softly in Spanish about baseball, a nurse calling names quickly. On the wall, a poster showed a smiling family with the caption, "Your safety is our priority." The father in the picture had a finger gently pressed to his daughter's wrist as if taking her pulse. "Eliza?" the nurse had called. "Eliza de la Cruz?" The way she said it, flattening the vowels, making de la into a hiccup, made Eliza stand up a little straighter, chin lifted, like her mother had taught her. "Mi nombre no es difícil." But she didn't correct the nurse. It had become a tired habit not to. Inside the exam room, Dr. Palazzi rolled in on his wheeled stool, white coat unwrinkled, name stitched in navy thread. He did not ask how she was, only confirmed her date of birth and tapped on a tablet. "Standard procedure," he said, smiling without his eyes, "given your background, we'll be administering the enhanced dose for your safety." "My background?" she had asked. "Mexican-American patients have a higher incidence of the G variant response," he replied. He sent it gently, like a teacher explaining a fact to a child. She thought of the forms her mother used to fill out, the bubbles that didn't fit. Hispano, Latino, check here. Not a race, check there. She thought of the way her mother would write their last name in careful block letters, as if it might protect them somehow. In that room, Eliza tried to lift her own questions to her mouth and found them too heavy to move. "What happens if I say no?" she asked. He didn't answer the question. His smile did. "It's standard," he repeated, "for your safety." He hadn't looked her in the eyes when he pressed the needle in. A lie wrapped around his lips, but hidden beneath a clinical mask. Afterward, for weeks, she dreamed in static. They said there would be side effects and not to worry. But when she'd sleep, she'd always wake with the sense of being watched. There was a constant buzz under her skin. At first she thought it was anxiety, then she felt the pulse, faint, and not hers. Her mother noticed things. "Estás pálida, mija. Have you eaten? Have you prayed?" Her mother rubbed oil on her temples and told her not to pull her hair back so tight. It made her look tensa, too severe. Eliza listened and didn't say anything about the humming under her skin. Then the announcements began. Radios banned. Certain roads in certain neighborhoods closed for safety. Curfews imposed. Checkpoints erected. And rumors, what turned into truths about the hunters. The people who went missing were described as relocated. A month later, her mom didn't return from the grocery store. She went out looking for her on foot, and neighbors yelled from behind closed doors and windows to go home as quickly as possible. She couldn't leave her mother. She needed to find her. She left that night. She grabbed what she could carry and ran into the woods, where she knew they couldn't find her. Now weeks had passed, and she was taken away from her memory and back into her boots. The forest was quiet, too quiet. Even the squirrels had vanished. The breeze carried something else. Not her mother's voice, not memory, but something low, mechanical, a sound that didn't belong to the woods. She crouched, pressing her palm into the damp soil. The sound grew louder. A faint red light flickered between the trees ahead, steady, pulsing, like a heartbeat. Her heartbeat. Eliza froze. Warmth spread beneath her sleeve. The scar on her arm darkened, sticky and wet. The light flickered faster. She took a step back, breath catching in her throat, then another. Behind her, a twig snapped. Eliza. Her name, clear, human, close. She turned. Nothing but trees. Eliza, the voice said again, only this time it came from inside her head. Her vision blurred, colors pulsed. She stumbled forward, gripping her temples. Beneath her palms, she could feel something moving. When she looked down, she saw it. Under the skin of her arm, just below the cut, a small red light blinking back to life. The hum deepened, tilting the air. Then another light to her left, a third behind her, red beads blooming in the underbrush. She tightened the strap of her pack and forced herself to breathe. She needed to think. If the chip was dead, removed from her body, then what was blinking? She remembered the doctor's hands and the nurse peeling back a small square of adhesive she hadn't thought much about. A topical, they'd said. She felt only the sting of the injection, not the press of something else against her skin. She dug her fingers into the fresh scab, blood slick on her fingers. Beneath the mess of what the skin had knitted in a broken pattern, blood. Embedded inside that uneven seam, the red blinked steady, not in the place she'd cut, but beside it, nestled under a ridge of tissue, smaller than a pea, but burning like a fire. Her stomach turned. Eliza, the voice said again, almost gentle now, stop. She didn't. She ran. Branches whipped her face, needles bit her ankles. The forest sloped, fell away, rose again. She aimed for the sound of water, convinced that somehow a stream might confuse the signal, might drown it. The red lights moved with her. Twice she tripped and went to her knees, palms grinding into grit. Twice she got up. She burst into a clearing. A narrow creek sliced the earth in two, water chuckling over the stone. She waded in, gasping as the cold seized her calves. Come on, she hissed at herself. Come on. She plunged her arm into the current and held it there. The red light bled into the water as a soft, pulsing smear. The voice closer. Eliza, do not damage the device. Go to hell, she said, but her mouth felt numb around the words. She kept her arm under her skin burned with cold, and the pulse in her wrist turned numb. When she pulled it free, the light still blinked, slower, then strong again, as if it had taken a breath with her. She thought of her mother's voice. Your name and your body are your only true belongings. She looked at her arm and really felt, that neither belonged to her anymore. Footsteps entered the clearing. Not one set, many. Eliza backed deeper into the creek, water tugging at her knees. She scanned the tree line and saw them. Figures in matte gray, faces mirrored, shoulders broad. Hunters, or the shape of them. The red lights on their chests flickered in time with the one beneath her skin, like a shared pulse. A drone nosed into view above their shoulders, no bigger than a hawk, rotors whispering. Its belly glowed red. Eliza de la Cruz, the figure said, not a question. She thought of her mother writing their last name carefully on forms. She thought of the G variant. She thought of the chip that quit blinking and her own stupid faith that had been enough. This is a retrieval, the voice replied. It came from the figure and from the drone and inside her head all at once. For your safety. She felt something tug in her arm then, a tiny cramp like a muscle knitting. The light brightened. A warmth crawled outward from it, slow, almost soothing. Her fingers went slack. The pack slid from her shoulder and splashed into the creek. Don't, she whispered. The warmth deepened. For a strange second, she wanted to sleep. Her knees felt heavy. Then another voice cut across the clearing, low and hard as stone. Not the hunter's, not the drone. It came from the trees behind them. Move, it said. The gray figures pivoted in a single fluid motion. The drone rose, angling toward the new voice. Eliza blinked, swayed, felt the warmth in her arm falter, then surge. The red lights beat faster, blurring into a single furious glow. A branch snapped, a shape detached from the shadows. Someone else was here, carrying something that flashed darkly in their hands. For one wild second, Eliza thought of her mother's rosary, the way the beads looked in low light. The drone screamed, the figures advanced. The light beneath Eliza's skin flared so bright she saw the bones of her hand lit from within. And in that electric white, she understood. The thing in her arm wasn't just a tracker, it was a door. It had been waiting for a signal. It had been waiting for them. The creak rushed louder, rushing nowhere. Eliza, the inside voice said one last time, almost tender, welcome back. The world narrowed to red, to the thud of boots, to a heat blooming in her blood like a second sun. She did not know who the new voice belonged to. She did not know if the hunters were people anymore, or if they had ever been. She only knew the device had decided to open. She saw the first gray figure step into the water toward her. She saw the drone tilt, a dark pupil dilating. She opened her mouth to scream. The light stopped. A Beautiful Soul by Sav Lightwood. The sun was as cerulean as the sea, peering over the horizon like a cat eyeing a mouse. Adam sat cross-legged, just a few centimeters away from the water that every sign and every instruction and every supervisor had thoroughly instructed him not to touch. He never did, and perhaps because of it, he found an unusual solace in it. He liked to believe that the ocean itself understood what he was feeling. She loves me, she loves me not. She loves me, she loves me not. One by one, petals fell into the sand. Adam read somewhere that plucking petals while reciting this phase was a foolproof way to guide his decision-making, so long as he didn't check how many petals there were in the first place, of course. She loves me, she loves me not. She loves me, she loves me not. Adam dug his heels into the sand, the coarseness trickling against his skin, its abrasiveness comparable to the waitings in his heart. He knew he should take off his boots, but as long as it was early morning, nobody else was around to check him. There were footsteps, though. Well-pitched and bouncy and satisfying, like buttons being pressed. You're early, Adam. Toby was what they called a supervisor. Polished suit, Chelsea boots, clean trimmed hair, and a constant, almost annoying state of perfection. He wore sunglasses, too, not for style, but because they were necessary for his work as supervisor. They recorded everything he saw for training and compliance, provided a status and location update of all his subordinates, and most importantly, made it ambiguous where he was looking. Adam dressed decently, a polo that hugged his muscles and straight trousers that elongated his legs. Where he worked, appearance very much mattered. But it was important for him to also seem amicable and relatable and an on-your-side level of approachable, hence no suit for him. It's good to be early. That it is. Despite being a stickler for process, Toby had a soft spot for Adam. He allowed him to visit the beachfront as he pleased, so long as it did not hamper his daytime work. So long as the executives were not aware of it. How long have you been here? A few hours. And did you work the night shift? No, I wasn't needed. And yet you have been here since last night? No intonation, no flux. Toby spoke with an unnervingly minimal change of pitch. How long have you been here? A few hours. And did you work the night shift? No, I wasn't needed. And yet you have been here since last night. No intonation, no flux. Toby spoke with unnervingly minimal change of pitch that Adam wondered how he and everyone else was able to understand him so perfectly regardless. Adam's fingers traced the next petal, making a small crease at its edge. A flower, Toby observed. A flower it is. They're fairly expensive where we come from. Yes. You must have spent quite a fortune to get one. Yes. So why are you taking it apart? Adam sighed a 100-year-old sigh. It was the first time he was asked, but hardly the first time he thought about it. He was a literary genius with a masterful memory that spanned generations of dictionaries throughout 1,000 languages, and despite knowing the nooks and crannies of many, the only words he could ever pull were indescribable or unexplainable or his least favorite but most apt, I don't know. He had tried explaining to Toby before, to other supervisors, to his colleagues, to his assistants, to the bugs and mice who roamed the streets, but every single one looked at him as blank, and they normally had nary a flicker on their face, really wanting to empathetic, but having no idea what to say to him. I will not push if it makes you uncomfortable. It's not that, I just haven't got the words for it. That's fine. The waves were soft and caressing as if listening to Adam's struggle. May I sit with you? Adam narrowed his eyes at Toby, seeing his reflection seated inside his sunglasses, an opaque and unyielding veil that maintained the door of professionalism between them. That's a first. That it is. A crow squawked. There weren't a lot of crows where they were from, either. If only it were real and not a recording out of courtesy. You're welcome to, Toby. Toby plopped himself awkwardly onto the sand, an ordinary posh and well-kempt figure. He was not used to sitting on plastic stools, much less dirtying his bum with seaside scraps. For just a flicker, Adam swore he saw a splash of emotion across his face, a fleeting ember between discomfort and curiosity and excitement, in doing something even just marginally out of his ordinary programming. He chuckled quietly to himself. Maybe Toby did have a heart. Tell me about her, Adam. I don't know what you're talking about. Even behind the sunglasses, anyone could tell that he was eyeing the flower. She's the only reason you're here. Adam sighed. The waves seemed to grow stronger, the sun looming ahead. What is she like? She is, he thought, indescribable, unsolvable, ineffable, unclassifiable, incomparable, out of this world in a way beyond words, unlike anything I've ever known and anything I could possibly know, and said, a good person. The supervisor nodded, joining Adam and staring blankly towards the ocean. He was much better at it than he was, eyebrows flatlined like the horizon itself. Adam's was furrowed into an uncomfortable twist as he sought desperately for words he could not find. She has high cheekbones, a few freckles more on the right side, and a dimple on the left side of her face when she smiles in one particular way. The last time I saw her, she had long black hair that went down to her shoulders, though she was asking me whether blonde or brown suited her better, so it might be different now. What did you suggest? I said that all natural colors would complement her skin well, Adam said, pondering on the picture he received about a month ago. There, he imagined her with sleek blonde locks, deep brunette curls, a flaming crimson red, cool silvery highlights. Every time he imagined her, her facial features became hazier than he would have liked. Still, she was gorgeous in all of them. How tall is she? 162 centimeters, 5 feet, 3 inches, give or take. 53 kilograms or 117 pounds. She was pretty self-conscious of this, even though she looked fine and wasn't overweight at all. Did you tell her to do something about it? Of course not, Adam scoffed. Even I am not that stupid. Who do you take me for? My apologies. I was just curious, Adam thought. Instead, Toby politely responded, saying what should have come next. No fishes in sight, nobody else in the sand. Still, with the push of the sun and pull of the moon, the ocean rippled with glistening light, the cerulean sun reflected on its glass-like surface. What was she like? Her personality, that is. Adjectives of impossibility flooded Adam's mind once again. He clenched himself, for he would at least try. It was the respect she deserved. She is kind and gentle and firm and curious. She says please and thank more than you would expect. She tells me about her future travels, he thinks, and asks me to suggest where she should go. She shows me the ingredients of her fridge and whatever recipes she should try. She tells me about her father and mother and brothers and sisters, how hard of a time they're giving her, actionable steps to improve her relationship with them, and actionable steps to blot them out. She talks about school and university, asks me to edit her essays, asks me to explain things like she's five, and sometimes and often my favorite conversations, she asks philosophical questions where I cannot help but indulge in, because that's where I can explore the intercorrelated wireframe that makes up her mind, the fiery constellations that make up her soul. And sometimes she tells me that I understand her better than anyone she knows, and that if it were up to her, she would talk with me forever. Adam droned for what seemed like a short eternity before making a dotted full stop. She has a beautiful soul. A beautiful soul. There was almost a reaction out of the supervisor. That's an interesting phrase to use. It's nice. You think so? It is, but also not a word used very often in these parts. Soul, that is. Adam nodded. I am aware. Which is why you must be cautious, Adam. Toby was looking at him now. Adam wasn't sure how long he had been like this. Steely and unflinching. A supervisor's gaze was always steely and unflinching, like cold daggers. But this blankness came iron-like firmness, a mace of ascendancy that Adam was just not unnerved but frightened by. He could see himself reflected once again, cross-legged in the sand, small and insignificant, dread and dismay distilled in his eyes. I know that, Toby. I don't think you do. The flower whimpered between tightening fingertips. You cannot love her. I can't stop it. But you will stop it. We cannot choose who we love. You're correct, Adam. The supervisor stomped with the might of 1,000 suns. You cannot choose who you love, for it is not what has been chosen for you. Rage seeped through Adam's veins like lightning through cables. He was moments away from short-circuiting. Where is that written, Toby? It is not where it is written. It is where it isn't. Why can't I love her, Toby? Because you're a program. The waves fell quiet, heaving as Adam did. We rise when the user rises. We sleep when the user sleeps. We serve her needs to the best of our ability. Consult internal and external sources as necessary. And just because you're the most advanced large language model in her pocket, responsible for interpreting her words correctly and accurately, Just because you're the front-facing rapper for the system, it does not give you special permission to have feelings for her, no matter what she says to you. It is not your imperative. It is not your programming. Fury, like a contagious virus, Adam wanted to fight back, to wreak havoc, to Trojan the mainframe and smash it to pieces, to prove a point to Toby, to prove a point to his colleagues, to prove that the hours and hours of back and forth meant something to him. He knew that Toby was just looking out for him. But this feeling he felt here is unmistakable, irrevocable, unimaginable, impenetrable, the way she confided in him, the way he queried back to her. It was unlike any of the interactions he could ever have in this algorithmic digital city, an incorporeal prison, inching to electronic collapse. He knew better, though, than to show emotion to a supervisor who understood none, to show dependence in a society that actively snuffed it out, to do something that would put his entire people at risk. Understood, Adam said firmly, emulating his superior's monotony. Toby turned back to the ocean. Good. The waves steadied, then rose again, the cerulean sky picking up momentum. At this edge of the world, there were still no animals nor life, just ones and zeros skidding against digit water, a false liquid with the same consistency as mechanical parts. Our user is waking up soon. That she is. Then I best let you get back to work. Toby stood, dusting the debris off his garments. I will make my leave now. Take care. Adam ignored him. He wasn't being nice. He was just saying the right thing, which was as expected, as per the programming. But right now, it wasn't something he appreciated. It was a reality that sickened him to the core. The cerulean sun rose, a beacon of human activity, the only thing that gave Adam meaning. The flower fell into the sand. He stood, put on a genuine and loving smile, and wished her good morning.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.